Parshas Vayechi contains a very tender moment. All the jockeying and all the turmoil of the last three or four parshios comes to a very, very neat resolution. The family finally is together, not just together in location, but together in spirit. And Yaakov gathers his children around his deathbed to say goodbye. And there's a reunion, which has been very elusive in the last couple of parshios, of 12 brothers. It's not clear whether Yosef stood around with the other brothers, who had his own session, but he had his own moment. And the Gemara Pesachim actually says, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, that was the first time that Shema Yisrael was uttered. In our imagination, Shema Yisrael is the anthem of Jewish martyrdom. So many Jews have gone to their death over the last 2,000 years, saying Shema Yisrael, screaming Shema Yisrael, pledging their love for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Shema Yisrael began as a very simple pasuk of unity. The 12 brothers of Yisrael, the 12 sons of Yisrael, the 12 sons of Yaakov, are gathered around his deathbed. In the way that they would ultimately march in the desert hundreds of years later, the same formation. And Yaakov inquires of his own children, the Gemara Pesachim says, are you all believers? Are you all consistent? Are you all cohesive? Are you all... Because he had assumed, and so much of the tragedy of the end of Bereishis was based on the premise that the process of selection that had dominated the first part of Sefer Bereishis would also inform the second part of Sefer Bereishis. It's just like Yitzchak was chosen and Yishmael was discarded, just like Yaakov was chosen and Esav was discarded. Similarly, there'd be brothers who were chosen and others who would be discarded. The brothers certainly assumed that Yosef was meant to be discarded. He was an evil seed. He was toxic. He was too ambitious, so they sold him. At some points, it may have seemed as if Yehuda was meant to be discarded when he commits these flagrant crimes. Shimon is imprisoned. Maybe certain of the brothers assumed this was his punishment for the Shechem episode. So Yaakov, it's finally dawning on every one of these people, these sons of Yaakov, Yaakov himself, I think that's the heat. Right, that the process of selection has ended. And the process of selection has yielded a process of inclusion. Now everyone is part of this family, part of this tribe, part of this clan. Some of the tensions were expressed in determining who would lead the clan, but now everyone is part of the clan. So Yaakov inquires of his children, are you all part of this movement now? And they all respond, Shema Yisrael, listen, Father Israel, listen, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Or as Art Scroll would write, listen, O Israel. He wasn't named O Israel. Listen, Israel. Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem. People come over to me and ask me, and how to have Kavana during davening? So we'll first start with Shema. Don't say, hear, O Israel. We're not Irish. We don't speak O Israel. Listen, you're announcing to your people. It's like one of these archaic, old, obsolete translations from the 50s when you would proclaim something here, oh, like some British person probably. Thank you. So it's probably some British translation or something. So just when you say Shema Yisrael, try to get the, we'll get to the trailer, try to get the O out of your mind. Try to get that O. Just, you're announcing to Am Yisrael as they announce to their father, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. To which Yaakov responds, Baruch Shem Kivod Machus Eliyahu Baruch. Thanks to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that this family has reached the stage where they're no longer struggling for inclusion or exclusion, but it's a cohesive unit. And then he gathers them, interestingly enough, for their brachas. Now you would think that each child should have a private audience with Yaakov Avinu. Isn't it more delicate? Isn't it more suitable? Isn't it more emotional if each father, each son should have a moment with his father to say goodbye? It's even more expected because Yaakov doesn't just have brachos for his children, he also has, at various stages, censure and critique. He will critique Reuven. He will chide Shimon and Levi. So it's not just more appropriate to call them in for their private audience so that you have that intimate setting, but it's even embarrassing. It's a bit mortifying to call people in together as a group and then chide them in the presence of their other brothers. It could even be injurious. It could even lead to further fighting and tension. And yet Yaakov seems insistent. Look at the first source. Vayikra Yaakov al banav vayomer. Hey asvu, gather. Ve'agidu lachem eisecher yikreschem achrisei yamim. Yaakov is the first person to ever think about achrisei yamim. In fact, according to Chazal, Yaakov had intended to disclose the details of Mashiach, when Mashiach would come. Who was the other person who had intended to disclose the details? Anyone know?
Bilam.
Not really. Who was the other Jew? Bilam is question. Who was the other Jew that wanted to disclose the details? No. Another person? Daniel. Daniel, when he saw those dreams, wanted to disclose the details, and the Malach came and said, they're better left undisclosed. Because messianism is very dangerous in that sense. On the one hand, we are religion that's oriented around messianism. We wait for that end point of history. We're not living linear history. We're living history that has an end point of redemption, and our purpose as Jews is to redeem ourselves and to redeem an entire planet by our own personal national arc. On the other hand, messianism can be sometimes very, very dangerous. It can lead us into fantasy. It can lead us into escapism. Some of you know one of the great failed messiahs was whom? Who is the greatest? The most tragic, traumatic failed messiah. He announces in 1666 he's a messiah. A third of the Jewish world sells their possessions, moves to Israel. It turns out to be a fraud. And it leads to a great, great depression in the Jewish community because people exchange current struggles for tomorrow's promises, for tomorrow's mirage. We better tomorrow. And Judaism is a here and now religion. We struggle with our issues. We embrace our world. We try to change our world. If that world is the state of Israel, if that state or that world, other places we live, we're an embracing religion. We're a present. We struggle with issues in the present. We try to improve our world. So Yaakov is withheld. Yaakov wanted to, first Rashi, you know, Eli Weber would be happy if I quote the first Rashi. Dikesh Yaakov legalos es hakeitz. Yaakov wanted to reveal the details. And it was withheld from him. What's the textual indicator that it was withheld? How do we know that he wanted to, but it was withheld? It was closed? Anyone know?
Separation.
Well, very good, Shmuel, Jonathan. There's no separation between Parshas Vayigash and Parshas Vayichi. Normally, Parshas and the Torah are separated by an empty space of at least how many letters?
Nine.
Here, between Vayigash and Vayichi, if you're a Baal Kriya, it's very hard to find where Vayichi starts, because it starts literally in the middle of a row of letters, the middle of a continuation, a string of letters. So that textual closure, there's no opening, according to one day in Rashi, reflects Yaakov's imaginative closure. His imagination was closed. So here's Yaakov gathering, and just in case you missed it, source 1, part Aleph, once again, he katsu v'shemu b'nei Yaakov. In the first pasuk he writes, hey asvu v'agid alachem. In the second pasuk, he katsu v'shemu b'nei Yaakov. Why does Yaakov choreograph that final moment, parting from his children, which is a personal, private affair, especially in light of his critique? Why is he adamant that everyone stands together by the Sadr's back? And the answer is based on my introduction, but with a little bit more elaboration. And to answer my question, I want to point you to a very different question. Let's skip 26 psukim. It's still source Aleph, but we're now 26 psukim later, right after all the brachas have been doled out and distributed. Kol Eila Shifte Yisrael. This is a summarizing pasuk. Shnei Masar. There are 12 Shifte Yisrael. Vizos Asher Diber Lehem Aviyem. These are the words, the brachot that Yaakov delivers to them. Vayivarech Otam. And he blesses them. Ish Asher Kibir Chato. Each one got their appropriate blessing. What is that phrase? Ish Asher Kibir Chato. It's extraneous. It's redundant. Of course they got their blessings. What is that phrase at? Ish Asher Kibir Chato. So Rashi comments, and I quoted the original source, the Medrash for you, source number Beis. Ma Talmud Lomer, line 2, source Beis. Isha Sheki Berchaton Berachaton. Levisher Berchon Yehuda Ba'aryeh. Yehuda got the strength of a lion. Vedan Ben Nachash, and Dan was likened to a snake. Naftali Ba'ayalah, like a gazelle, the quickness of a gazelle. Binyamin Bezeich. Chazar V'kulam Kulam Ki Echad. This phrase indicates that after Yaakov distributed all their specific brachos, he then collectively gave them Asan Achrayos, Arayos, line number 4, he made them all lions. Asan Achashin, he made them all snakes. Even though he doled out specific brachos to each one of the brothers, in the end he reconfigured and distributed all the brachos to all the brothers. Isha Sherki Berchato, each brother's bracha, Berachotan, was distributed to all. So what's the point of distributing singular brachos if you then shuffle the deck and give out all the brachos to all the brothers? The answer is one word. And it starts with a D. And that's the theme of Yaakov's parting scene. It's called diversity. Each brother got their own bracha. And that bracha was distinctive, was singular, was exclusive. You can't be a lion if you're a snake. You can't be a snake if you're a gazelle. You can't be a wolf. Each of them had them. These are all metaphoric. Each of them has their skill set. Each of them has their form of religion. Each of them has their personal relationship with Hashem and the talents which are expressed through that personal relationship. But now Yaakov is pleading with them, now form a collective. Form a group. This is the first time in Vayechi there's a group, there's a clan. We are transitioning now from individuals to a clan of people, all of whom are talented. Not one rock star, one cult leader, one person after whom everyone follows and models himself in that image of Avhamon Goyim of Avraham or Yitzchak. Now there's a group of people that are going to form a clan, form a tribe, which will ultimately form a nation. And now it's not about individual talent, but collaboration. How can you form a clan of people, talented people, that are all included, that are all part of the leadership, that are all different, with differences not just tolerated, but cultivated, and people are pollinated by the presence of others, because if I'm part of this collective, I may be a lion, but Dunn is part of the collective, so I benefit from his snake-like, whatever that refers to. If I'm a snake, but Naftali's part of the equation, I benefit from Naftali's contribution. If I'm Binyamin, I'm a Zave, I bring my talents to the mix, but I benefit from whatever Reuven's able to provide. That's what Yaakov is desperate to achieve. Yaakov is desperate to achieve a transition into a collective, and they all have to be there so they can see each other, respect each other, appreciate each other, see differences, hear differences, know that talents sometimes express themselves in negative or dangerous fashion. Reuven's emotions run very deep. Sometimes they run too deep, as they did with the story with Yaakov. After all, Reuven's protest, what does Yaakov really censure Reuven about? Who knows Vayechi? What does Yaakov censure Reuven about? Bilhah. Because Reuven intercedes on behalf of his mother Leah. Because right after Rachel dies, according to the simple pshat of the Gemara and Shabbos, Yaakov, instead of living with Leah, now moves his bed into Zilpah's tent. And Reuven is outraged, and Reuven intercedes, and Reuven fights for moral justice, and Reuven is indignant. And Yaakov says, Reuven, that wasn't appropriate. You're not the one, Reuven, who should be protesting about my sleeping arrangements. You were already involved twice in marital confusion. When was Reuven involved in marital confusion before he protested on his mother's behalf?
The mandrakes,
the roses. Reuven purchases roses for his mother. Mandrakes. Which century did you pop in from? Right? Reuven purchases, it's called flowers in there. Reuven purchases flowers, roses. You know, go to the store and ask them for mandrakes. Reuven purchases flowers for his mother, and Leah barters those mandrakes, so she gives them to Rachel, and then Yaakov spends time with Leah that evening, because Leah had purchased Yaakov for that evening, and Reuven is responsible. But even before then, before there were mandrakes, when was Reuven involved in sexual and marital confusion? Reuven is born out of a confused arrangement, right? Who was supposed to really marry Yaakov that first night?
Rachel.
And who was swapped in Rachel's place? Leah. Who was born out of that swap? Reuven. Reuven's the son of confusion. He's not Chalil V'chasa, a bastard, but he was not supposed to be. So you're the last person who should be involved in Parshas Vayishlach, in rearranging the marital procedure. Let out someone else. But Yaakov's really telling his brothers, his children, but that's great. Reuven feels passion. Reuven feels his mother's insult. Reuven has moral indignance. Reuven feels political injustice or domestic injustice deeply. Now the question is, how do you calibrate it? How do you moderate it? When do you express it? What's the right place? What's the right time? So even when Yaakov chides his children, he isn't incriminating them. He's rather pointing out, I wish you should feel the passion for your sister Dina that Shimon HaLevi felt, but not in a murder sense, not in a bloody sense, not in an understanding. There's no criticism here. It's just people are different. And those differences should be tolerated and cultivated, and everyone has to be together so they can all benefit from each other's traits, from each other's talents, and form this collective that will ultimately become Am Yisrael. But sadly enough, This year in particular, this is a share I obviously give every year, but this year in particular, discussing tolerance, diversity, respecting and appreciating other approaches to Avodas Hashem. Sadly, this year has even greater relevancy because of the trauma we're living through in Eretz Yisrael. But it's an important message. What are the limits of tolerance? What are the values of diversity? How should that trait be seen? What was Yaakov intending here? What's the message of Parshas Vayechi? So first and foremost, the message itself. That tolerance and pluralism within boundaries is a religious ideal, is a religious ethic. In today's jargon, so often you say, oh, that person, he's pluralistic. That person, he likes diversity. And those phrases sometimes are akin to saying, oh, he's less firm. Oh, yeah, that person is pluralistic. No, pluralism, open-mindedness, the ability to see that you can't see it all, that other people have ways to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, other people have talents that you just can't develop simply because of your limitations. That's part of being a firm person. The inability to see that is a flaw in your firmkeit. As I'll describe a bit later, the inability to tolerate it is a moral flaw. The inability to appreciate it is a theological limitation. So it's just to switch your perspective. Sometimes we get caught in word traps where we utter these words so involuntarily that they trap us into conventions of thought. Let me give you an example now. You all know what's happening in Beit Shemesh, right? You've read about it, you've heard about it. My last tweet, which I tweeted on Erev Shabbos, was the following. I got this into under 140 characters. One of the phrases I detest is the phrase ultra-Orthodox. Why do I detest it? Because there's not a single Orthodox Jew alive that shouldn't aim to be ultra-Orthodox. And if you think that the Haredi approach is a more firm approach than yours, then you should become Haredi. You have every bit of a moral responsibility to be as ultra-Orthodox as you can be. I don't think that, for me, that's the ideal approach. They think it is. I feel that my approach is the ideal approach. I just am imperfect in applying it. But I feel like this is the ideal approach that Hashem wants of me. So I'm aiming to be an ultra-Orthodox Jew within my Ashkafa. The second that you brand one community ultra-Orthodox, you are silently whispering to yourself that I'm less Orthodox. And you acquit yourself from challenge, from growth, from development. So I like social terms like Haredi or Yeshivish or whatever terms don't convey. Take that term out of your mind. That isn't a judgment, but don't judge yourself as less firm. And if you really feel that it's true, then you have a responsibility to get out of this yeshiva and go to Beit Shemesh or the Mea Shearim and become ultra-Orthodox. How could you give yourself any less? How could you be moderate Orthodox? How could you be lukewarm Orthodox? There's a travesty. And sometimes these words trap us. And one of the words which trap us is, oh, that person's open-minded. That person's pluralistic. As if, oh, he's less firm. That makes you more firm, not less firm. The inability to stretch your mind. What are the limitations of pluralism? These are the limitations. Limitations are orthodox behavior. To be pluralistic, you have to respect every Jew. You have to feel a common historic destiny and past and legacy with every single Jew, no matter what level of halakha they keep, no matter which country they live in. But in terms of validating alternate approaches, there has to be orthodox fidelity. And orthodox fidelity is based on three conditions. Number one, commitment to Torah given in Har Sinai. Number two, commitment to rabbinic authority. Number three, commitment to the 13 theological principles of faith. That's what constitutes orthodoxy. As long as someone is operating within those three parameters, divinity of Torah, authority of Rabbanan to interpret that Torah, and you can't just turn your back on rabbinic, oh, the rabbi said this 2,000 years ago, but it no longer applies. Number three, it's not just halachic fidelity, but it's also commitment to 13 principles of monotheism, of Jewish history. As long as a person operates within those parameters, that person is orthodox. I may disagree with their conclusion, but that person is orthodox and has to be treated as an orthodox person with respect, not chalila v'chas to suggest that people who aren't orthodox shouldn't get respect, but that should be something that's valid in your mind, even if you disagree with it. So for example, just to give you a realistic, relevant example. If someone gets up and says, Chazal didn't want women having aliyos because it was disrespectful to the community. It wasn't kavod tzibur for women to have aliyos at the same. But who cares about Chazal? That was 2,000 years ago and times have changed. That's a non-orthodox position. That person is breaking with orthodoxy. The person gets up and says, 2,000 years ago, Chazal issued a statement, but I can make a diak in this ritva, or pshat in this rashba, and come up with a kula, and stretch something that the shach says, and allow a woman to have an aliyah. I may be opposed to it. But that's an orthodox process. So when he's using halacha in an orthodox fashion, you can't rail against, you can say, I disagree with that person, he may be dangerous in your mind, but you can't defame that individual's orthodoxy. And that language has to be very, very subtle but important. So first of all, in your minds, a transition has to take place whereby the more open-minded you are within reasons. Remember, they weren't bitsy. They weren't standing around Yaakov's bed singing other religions. They were saying, Shema Yisrael, Shem Elokeinu, Shem Echad, which was their religion, belief in God, and commitment to His word. So as long as people operate within that circle of orthodoxy, pluralism is a value. And it's a value on two fronts. It's a value first and foremost, because the more open-minded you are, the closer you are to understanding. Listen carefully. This isn't easy to get, but it's the most important. That's why I'm starting with it first. The more open-minded you are, the closer you are to understanding HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What I mean is as follows. The Gemara in Tanis. Take a look at source number Dalet. Amar Reb Elazar. Asid HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Some of you may have heard this from me before. Asid HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lasas Mechol HaSadikim. In the end of time, Hashem will make a circle and put the tzaddikim around the circle. Source number Dalet, $1. We'll make a circle and put the tzaddikim along the circle. And God will affix himself to the center point of the circle. All these tzaddikim who are aligned upon the circle, they're pointing with their finger at the midpoint. This is our God. We've waited for him. He will salvage us, will redeem us. Zeh Hashem, that means you're pointing, John. Zeh Hashem kivinu la nagila. Why is that final dance of the tzaddikim compared to a circle? Not a square, not a triangle, not a rectangle. What makes a circle geometrically unique? What are the geometric properties of a circle?
Equidistant from the center.
Infinite equidistant radii. Infinite equidistant radii. Which means, this is a circle, okay? Well, I can't turn it over. But let's say this were a circle, just for visual sake. Hashem is in the midpoint. Can we circle it? Hashem is in the midpoint. Okay? And there's a tzaddik standing on this part of the circle, and a tzaddik standing on the exact opposite part of the circle, right across the diameter. And the Sinai Kodesh Baruch Hu from totally different vantage points. Their view is totally different. But they're equidistant. They're both seeing HaKadosh Baruch Hu in equal proportion. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is so vast, and His will is so infinite, and His essence is so transhuman, that no one single person can grasp the totality of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's simply impossible. And anyone who says it is just proving, their ignorance. When I speak to high schoolers, because they're a little bit more vulnerable than you are, sometimes when I interview high schoolers and I speak in front of them, I say, if any Rebbe comes in and uses these two words, I don't care which yeshiva he comes from, I want you to walk out and go find another yeshiva. I'm not going to tell you which yeshiva to go to, but if any Rebbe uses these two words, you know that his yeshiva is not yeshiva you should go to. Which two words? The MS. This is the MS. That's a fraudulent statement. That is an inherently flawed statement. What he should be saying is, this is my emes. This is my way of serving Hashem. This is what I found to work for me. And sometimes you have to hear this lesson also in yeshiva. What, you think this is the only emes here in Gush Etzion? Dati Lumi is the emes? You're off your wall. You have to walk. There are thousands and thousands of B'nai Torah sitting in B'nai Brak who have a very different emes from you. This is what you think is your emes. This is based on your Abayim, based on your Masara, based on the way you've been raised, based on your families. This is the way you feel you can serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is a combination of values, of Ashkafa, of morals, of experiences. Well, you don't think you're going to be sitting next to some guy from Panavish in Olam Haba? You can't choose your seat in Olam Haba. He's going to put you down. Okay, let's see. Row C14. I get my seatbelt. Now next to me is Baba Bechassid, and to the right of me is a guy from Panavish. Hey, where's Gush? Where's the Gush section? No Gush section. It's one section. It's called the Emma section. It doesn't exist in this world. It only exists in the next world. The Emma section. Everyone has their Emma's. And the other word you should avoid like the plague Because it's the cousin of the word emes, is the word derech. This is the derech alimut. Because if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is infinite, then by definition, this Torah is also infinite. There's no one way to study Torah. You could spend, I promise you this, as someone having learned a lot of, you could spend your entire life, and 1,000 more lives, perusing every single contour of one single sugya and still never reach the end point. That's how infinite Hashem choose. Any sugya you've learned this year, you could spend your entire life on that sugya and still not reach tip of the iceberg. By definition, because you're exploring Hashem, and Hashem is infinite. So here in Yeshiva, we decide we're going to learn Rishonim, not because we don't want to learn Achronim, because we only have one life. We have limited resources, and we feel that the Rishonim will get us into the thrust of the matter, the heart of the issue, quicker. You know how many Marshas we're going to learn this year? Be lucky if we learn one. Because the Marsha dealt with a totally different part of the sugya. He dealt with, as Yavniel Parlant, the latter Marsha, the calculus of Mentosa says this, how does it calculate? The rest of the Gemara is a lot of calculations. Do you know what happens? What would happen if the Marsha walked through those doors right now? I'd be the first one running at that door, rolling in his dust. Because he knew more Torah in the white of his little pinky than everyone in that base matters upstairs, squared by a million. We just choose not to study him because we're just limited in our time and resources. So he's going to say, this is the Derech HaLimud? Are you kidding me? It's a distortion. It's a perversion, not a distortion. It's a theological perversion, not a moral distortion. So Rebbe tells you, this is the emes, he's giving you paganism. It's not giving you monotheism. He's giving you, this is Rabbi so-and-so's version of God. He's making it to seem as if a human being can paint God. It's impossible. So the first reason of tolerance is to realize there is no one way to serve Hashem. There is no one emes, there's no one ashkava, simply because the human mind is wrestling with the divine infinity. And that's a mismatch. So the best we can come away with is our own little souvenir. Your derech is your souvenir from that mismatch. I climbed Mount Everest and I survived. I wrestled with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will, and this is the derech that I've done, I can live by. It's a souvenir. You let someone sell you souvenirs? It's an old joke about a guy who goes up to Shemayim and the Malach greets him. The Malach says, look, I'm going to give you one of three doors to go to. You can join any room you want. So the Malach takes him and they open the first door. They look inside, people are eating and drinking, saying Divrei Torah. Fine. That's room number one. Room number two. Malach opens the door. People are eating, drinking, learning Divrei Torah. Fine. Then the Malach takes him to the third door and says, I'm going to open the door, but just for a second, to take a quick look. Promise me to be silent. Don't say a word. I'm going to shut the door quickly. Okay. Malach says to him, are you ready? Ready. You ready? Ready. One, two, three. Opens the door. Shuts it. But in that 1 second, the guy was able to take a quick glance and see what's in the room. What's in the room? They're eating, they're drinking, they're saying Divrei Torah. Malach says, that's your third choice. The guy turns to the Malach and says, I got to ask you something. It's a big deal. They're doing the exact same thing in room number three. Why do you make such a big song and dance? Close the door, keep quiet. 1 second. He says, got to understand, in that room, they think they're the only people in Shemayim. We don't want a room there. I think they're the only people there, so we don't want to ruin it for them. Is that what ruined it? I remember Rav Amital telling this stuff. Rav Amital is the Kohen Levracha. I'm not going to tell you what he said, but he said, these are the only three drachim I don't want you to join. I'm not going to tell you which, because things change. You have to beat it out of me, Kimchi. Because these three drachim are the only three drachim that assert they're the only derech. And the only derech that can be puzzled is a derech that asserts it's the only derech. And that's the primary thrust of it. It's not a moral issue to tolerate other people because we all have to get along, even people who are erroneous, even people who are off. It's not even a second issue that sometimes the experience is enhanced aesthetically. If you are the head of an orchestra, so you want some wind instruments, you want some violin string instruments, you want some percussion instruments, to make it more enriched, to make it more deep, to make contrasts. Part of aesthetics is contrasts. So part of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu is also aesthetics. Hashem service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was enriched by diversity. People look different. People have different views. People bring different talents to the surface. Take a look for a second at the Gemara in Brachos. The Gemara in Brachos, source number Gimel. I'm Rav Hamnuna. Haroach, let's say Yisrael. You see 600,000 Jews, you make a bracha. We don't really paskin these brachas that much. When's the last time you saw 600,000 Jews? But if you would, the Gemara at least feels you should make a bracha. What's the bracha you should recite? Baruch Chacham Razim. Blessed is the keeper of wise hidden secrets. Raz is a secret. Why? This is line number 2 again, source Gimel. She'ein da'atam domel ze leze. Because their viewpoints, their positions are not similar. Ve'ein partzufeim domim ze leze. And their faces are dissimilar. And only HaKadosh Baruch Hu can make people dissimilar. If I were to be, if I would have to make 600,000 people, they probably won't be the same. If I were to have to mint 600,000 people, how much diversity can I really program? How far can my imagination reach? It's limited. At some point, people would start duplicating each other in the way they look and the way they think, because my mind is too limited. Are we happy that people look different? Of course we are. What would happen if everyone looked the same? It'd be a nightmare. No one would get married, everyone would marry the same person, everyone would be a nightmare. Just like it's a blessing, a Kodesh Baruch Hu can make people look different, so it's a blessing and makes them think of it. This isn't mourning. You don't say, I'm looking at 600,000 people, I wish they'd all be the same, but unfortunately they're different, let's all get along and appreciate each other, and learn to tolerate each other. This is a bracha you give Hashem, you recite Hashem U'malchus, a Kodesh Baruch Hu. They're different. You made them different. Only you can make them different. Only you can make them look different. Only you can make them think differently. You should be blessed, because it's something I can't imagine ever being capable of. Baruch Chacham Arazim. Only after this is divine. This is a divine moment. I'm able to see divinity and divine capability in 600,000 people. If you ask me to make a lot of cakes, I can make cakes. If you ask me to make a lot of people, I can never reach that level. So part of it is aesthetics. Part of it is that by living together, we benefit from each other. And the truth is sometimes you have to learn to benefit even when you disagree. What's happening now in Beit Shemesh is nothing short of tragic on many levels. Ben Adam LaChavero, Ben Adam LaKadosh Baruch Hu, tremendous Chil Hashem. What happened yesterday to me, I feel like someone stabbed me, literally stabbed me. To walk around and wear Holocaust imagery, the latest protest, people, little kids, they put yellow stars on their lapels, and they actually staged that famous picture, that infamous picture in the Warsaw Ghetto where that little kid comes out with his hands up with the yellow Holocaust star. They actually staged that picture. They put a yellow star on one of the kids and he went out because the Zionists are treating us like the Nazis treated us. That's a desecration of the memory of Holocaust martyrs, and it's also a demonstration that you lack even an iota of historical perspective. To compare what's happening in this country to a Holocaust is simply, folly is an understatement. It's embarrassing. Should be kicked out of this country simply because our entire right to this country is a historical mandate. If you're not part of Jewish history, if you can compare, and I'm not in any way attacking one particular, because in our own community, we have the same associations. When we were expelled from Gaza, remember how people staged carrying a menorah out of the shul and out of the yeshiva? What were they trying to stage? When's the last time we carried a menorah out of someplace? From Beis HaMikdash. I cried when I saw that. When my children showed me that video, I remember when it was. I never scream at my kids, I never get angry, I went ballistic. I said, shut that video off right now. The Churban Beis HaMikdash Sheni was a desecration of history. It was a theological turning point in which God's presence was withdrawn from our community. The entire world changed. It was the darkest day in history. And you're comparing that to when the Jewish government, on its own decision, evicts, as tragic as it is, there's certain associations you do not make, and that just shows a lack of historical perspective. We lose our historical perspective, we are out of this country. Our presence here is because we believe we have a divine right to this country, and we've suffered to achieve this presence, and we're building something historic and messianic and redemptive. And you have to respect your past, and respect the differences in your past, and see the past in differences, not just as one homogenous timeline. So, on the other hand, okay, these are people who deeply care about their values. Do we care about our values as deeply as they do? And the challenge is to care deeply without expressing it in a monstrous form, without being vulgar, without being abusive, without being exploitative. But do we care about our own values? When people throw rocks on Shabbos as obscene, And as disgusting as that behavior is, these are people who really care about Shabbos. When you walk down the street in Midtown, do you care the same way about Chilul Shabbos when you see Jews violating Shabbos? Or do you just TT it because Shabbos does has become so effaced? And because our tolerance essentially erodes any sense of values. Well, everyone has their opinion, everyone has their position, and every position is appropriate, which it isn't, then our whole sense of sanctity and what a day should be like egresses. So sometimes we throw out the baby with the bathwater. Are we able to look at a community and say, look at this community, they care so deeply about levels of tznius, they care so deeply about community environment, that they're willing to ignore any sort of social pressure, any sort of social norm, and act like fools and imbeciles, but are able to bring yourself to the point of intense commitment to a value rather than feeble, lukewarm concession to public pressure. The next time you're about to buckle to public pressure, ask yourself, well, what does Beit Shemesh have to teach me? Am I able to feel a value so deeply that I'm willing to withstand public scorn and ridicule and stand by that value quietly, dignified, not in any way insulting any other people or exploiting them or physically abusing them, but stand for what I believe? Am I able, the next time I see an inappropriate picture, to say, you know what, if there's one thing that Beit Shemesh taught me, I shouldn't be looking at that picture. Because in that community, they're so radical, they're so extreme, that even healthily dressed people are abused in a very, very sad and tragic way. But it's a wake-up call for me, because what type of community of tolerance have I built? What price have I paid for a community of tolerance? Those are real issues, those are real challenges, and those are the backside of tolerance. Tolerance doesn't just mean you tolerate those people that are convenient for you, you tolerate the people that affirm your lifestyle, but you tolerate the people that challenge your lifestyle. Okay, what about Haredim? How much tolerance is there in our community? Not for the people of Beit Shemesh, the crazies, the 150, 200 Taliban crazies, but what about for real Haredim? How much Haredi phobia is there in our community? How much inability to accept their truth? Even though it's a truth with a particular flaw in it, because it's not as open-minded as ours, but it's built in, they're not being mean about it, because in their mind, we have veered, potentially, from that halachic circle. Because for them, it's not just Shemir Skaro Mitzvos, it's not just 13 principles, it's not just the fidelity of the Chachamim, but it's a certain commitment to Das Tara that we don't display. And that Das Tara is being violated when you accept Medinas Yisrael. Or that Das Tara is being violated when you eat secular knowledge. So in their mind, we have strayed from Orthodoxy. Although if you ask them, they probably won't even say that. But they're tolerant of each other, so that's an MS of Orthodoxy. It's not an Orthodoxy that's intolerant. They're tolerant of different yeshivas. They're tolerant of chassidus. They just feel that in their description of Orthodoxy, we may or may not. I'm not speaking, I believe that it's just political and it's institutional, but if a person were sitting here, he would eat in your house and he'd keep Shabbos in your house. It's just a question of unfortunate politics. But even if it's not, even if we'd say no, are you tolerant of him? You can't just be tolerant of people that are convenient for you to be tolerant of. You have to be tolerant of people that aren't. You're able to look at a Haredi and say that person is an MS. And not only will I tolerate that MS, but I will be enriched by that MS. Do you know how much Tara is being produced by that community today? Unprecedented. Unprecedented. There's a sefer being born every 5 minutes in B'nai Brak. The people gauge birth rates. There's a child being born every 3.7 seconds, whatever in the world. There's a sefer being produced every 10 seconds in B'nai Brak. If we wait 10 seconds, there'll be another sefer. That's because that community has been built solely on one ethic, the ethic of Tara. So it's not our ethic, it's not our MS. But we are the beneficiaries of that prodigious effort. And all the Torah you're learning is enhanced by. You're able to open yourself up to that Torah. You're able to go back. Shimon can tell you, right? Going back to America from Gush Etzion is not easy because a lot of the Torah energy in America is Haredi. You're able to walk into a Haredi shul and just feel comfortable and not feel that you have to protest and denounce and show who you are and just say, okay, brothers, we share more in common than we don't share in common, and let's put on our tefillin together and keep Pesach together and Tzavtar together. Then I'll go into a side room and I'll say, a bracha letzvagan al Yisrael, then I'll come back from Musaf. Whatever, not a big deal. Not making divisions. That's Yaakov's challenge, and that's really our challenge today. So the first challenge is to develop the norm that open-mindedness is part of Frumkeit. If you're open-minded in a healthy sense, that makes you more from. That's something the yeshiva stands for. and it's sometimes misunderstood. Because in today's world, there's a defensiveness to Judaism. We have to protect ourselves, and maybe in Chutz La'aretz, some of that protective stance is necessary. But here, living in Eretz Yisrael, sometimes when I meet boys who are applying to the yeshiva, I try to just show them the difference between life in Israel and life in America. Okay, in life, in my opinion, life in Chutz La'aretz, it's us and them. There's clearly a difference between Jewish culture and secular culture. And you can't just embrace the culture entirely. Everyone's building a wall. Question is, how high is your wall and how many windows are in that wall and how many doors do you place in that wall? So the windows and the doors and how high the wall is determines, do you partake of secular culture, do you not? What parts of secular culture, secular studies, Taramanda, Tikvah, whatever you call it. But you can't just throw yourself. It's not one integrated fabric. It's not one integrated existence. There are differences. Not racist differences, clearly, Bahas, not differences that should make you disrespect other people. But here in Israel, it's not us versus them. It's all us. There's no us as in them. It's all us. If there's prostitution in Haifa, that's my issue. If there's crime in Beersheba, that's my issue. If there's a fire in the Carmel, that's my issue. It's all us. You don't want to build any walls. You don't want to create any divisions. It's all us. It's who we are. Mashiach's not going to come and make pit stops in Alon Shemot, Efrat, Yerushalayim, and Mea Shearim. He's going to come when he comes, when the entire people is ready for him to come, whatever that readiness is gauged by. So sometimes in Israel, that pluralism resonates a little bit more deeply than it does in a much more divided world. That has to change. The attitude that pluralism within halakhic boundaries, within orthodox boundary, is a favorable, is a plus. If you can build yourself to that person that can find the good in all those around you, and all those orthodox and non-orthodox, every Jew, but certainly those who are aligned with you in orthodox behavior, you'll be a deeper Jew, you'll be a better Jew, you'll be a healthier Jew. Rather than constantly making divisions, this yeshiva and that yeshiva, and Rabbi Tarragon's shir versus Rabbi Friedman's shir, and the guys who sit in the front row, Rabbi Tarragon's shir versus the guys who sit in the second row, the guys who sit on the right part of the front row, who went to Rambam, who didn't go. So then you'll be left with one boy in your world, one person. It's me, me, and only me. Second, you start to feel, okay, there are differences, and that person's difference is expressed. When I walk into Mir, I'm totally at home. Because 99% of what they're doing is like what I do. I get up in the morning, put on tefillin, daven before Shiva, zman tefillah, do chesed, learn Torah. When I walk into Vizhnitz, I don't understand a thing of what's going on there. And that's what makes it more important, because it reminds me there are things about Hashem I can't understand. It's more important for me to walk into Vizhnitz than to walk into Mir. Mir affirms who I am. Vizhnitz challenges who I am. Makes me, it corroborates that there are parts of our Kodesh Baruch I just can't get. So now let me go to a Vizhnitz tish. It's hard for someone with a list. Let me go to a Bell's tish. Yes, you're to say. I'll go to the Bell's tish. Let me go to a Bell's tish and sit and understand there are pathways to serving our Kodesh Baruch Hu that it's just not nascent in my personality. And all of a sudden, I can appreciate, I can incorporate, maybe I can, maybe I can't. That's what Yaakov is striving for. So he says, come together, stand around my bed. You're so different. Each and every one of you are different. Now I want you to look at each other, see those differences, respect those differences. Sometimes those differences spill over into crimes, but you still value the trait, even if sometimes there'll be crazies in Mea Shearim or in Beit Shemesh that will exploit young girls walking to school, Yaakov says. But it doesn't mean the entire culture is flawed. It doesn't mean that everyone is flawed. Just means that every society has its extremes. Maybe the leadership is too weak to oppose it. Maybe that's the flaw in that society. Leadership is too weak. Okay, what are the flaws in our society? Plenty of flaws in our society. So Yaakov situates them to teach them, this is a different period. Now it's about being together and seeing and appreciating differences. Let's just end with, let's start with source number 2. And I'll forget to 4 and 5 and skip 3. But. So it's number 2. Before Yaakov calls the brothers, and he calls in Yosef. And his agenda for Yosef is clear. Yosef is his ticket out of Egypt. Without Yosef's intercession, Yaakov won't just be buried in Egypt, he'll be enshrined, he'll be mummified. He'll turn into a pyramid, become a national shrine. It's the last thing he wants. So he pleads with Yosef, who has the authority to exhume his body, or in this case, not even exhume it, but bury him in Eretz Yisrael. And he imposes a very strange, or he employs a very strange tactic to convince Yosef. Simna yadcha, he tells Yosef, put your hand, tachasi reichi, in my loin, near his mila, which is a mitzvah. Put your hand near my loin and swear to me that you will fulfill my wishes. If I'm Yosef, I gotta be asking myself, that's how much you trust me? You don't think that your request is enough? Hanan, what if your parents, ask you tomorrow, please come to Yerushalayim, and they want to get together with you? You say, and you say, sure, I'll come. And your father says, you know what, sign the contract. I'm faxing you a contract, sign it. What happened? Did I miss a beat? And your son, you ask me, of course I'll come. But sign the contract. Yosef Atzad. This is an insult to Yosef. You're asking me to bury you. It's a mitzvah. It's common courtesy. Not such a big travel, not such a big journey. And you're asking me to take a shul? Anyone remember, we may have spoken about this earlier in the Sefer. Who else asked whom else to take a shvuah about something that that person should have just agreed with? And
Avram and Eliezer.
Avram and Eliezer. Avram asked Eliezer to find a bride for Yitzchak, and he said, make a shvuah. He says, I'm your trusted servant. And as we spoke about them, because sometimes we're able to perform based on an inner virtue or an inner compulsion because of what's right. And sometimes life is complicated and things get in the way and obstacles impede our path. And sometimes we need extra incentives to help us overcome those obstacles. And Yaakov knows that in the tranquility and the serenity of his deathbed, Yosef will nod his head. But when he's gone, politics will set in and bureaucracy will take his time away. And people will start suspecting him. There'll be a political smear campaign. Look, Yosef is leaving in the middle of the famine. He's leaving our country. The tabloids will have a field day. The paparazzi will stand by the border snapping pictures of Yosef betraying his Egyptian people. Dual loyalty, really cares more about Israel. And power will come up with half a dozen excuses that require Yosef to stay behind. And sometimes Yosef may even fall prey to those excuses and justifications. Just like Avram knows, those same obstacles may rear their heads for Eliezer, whose intentions are sincere, whose nobility is pure. So Yaakov and Avram have the foresight to lock it in to enough. Not because they distrust Yosef or Eliezer respectively, but because they are establishing ulterior motives, external obligating factors to help people overcome the natural day-to-day obstacles that prevent us from real success. Take a look at the Gemara Nedarim, source number 2, part Gimel. Gemara Nedarim Daf Ches, Minayin Shenishvayim L'Kaymes HaMitzvah. Strange question. How do you know you could take an oath to perform a mitzvah? What's the Havamina? Why should an oath to perform a mitzvah be Aser? It's an insult to Hashem. I'm putting on tefillin because I made a shvuah. Why should you put on tefillin? 1,001 reasons. Starting with Hashem told you. Symbolism. Putting a Torah on your body every day. Why should you learn Torah? 1,001 reasons. The last of which is because you made an oath. Why should you be moral and decent? 1,001 reasons. Bottom of the list because Hashem told you so. Or you made a shvuah. You're going to take a shvuah and introduce some external motive, some extraneous compulsion to something that should be pure, noble, unadulterated, between you and Hashem, not contractual, not oath-driven, not obligated, not framework-enhanced. You're going to ruin a mitzvah by thinking of the external reasons you have to perform that mitzvah? That's why the Gemara says in the Dar, maybe you shouldn't. And the Gemara can only ratify that behavior because it's a pasuk. David HaMelech in Kuf Yutes, source Gimel, line 2. Nishvati va'akayema lishmar mishpatei tzidkecha. You guys know the song. Nishvati va'akayema. David HaMelech already validates that behavior. David HaMelech knows the human psyche pretty well. He fell victim to the frailties of the human condition. He knows that sometimes it's not enough to know what's right. You have to be obligated. beyond religious authority to do what's right. And that's what Yaakov realizes by forcing Yosef into a shvua. That's what Avram realizes by forcing Eliezer into a shvua. So the question is, guys, what can we do? No one should take a shvua to do any mitzvah. We try to avoid shvuas. That's not our world. Try to avoid oaths. Try to avoid nedarim. Try to avoid saying Hashem's name in vain. These constant oaths, and it's not our world. Some people sometimes, you know, in the what do they call them? The text world, there's a whole language text. LOL means laughing out loud, and MIHL, my humble opinion. So what does OMG mean? We all know what it means, but you have to be careful not to say it. Because if you say, oh my, you may violate an issur d'oraisa by saying Hashem's name without any purpose. If you feel that Hashem's name in another language is still Hashem's name. Train yourself not to say that phrase. And it's just something which rolls off of our tongue and we're trained to say it. To be careful not to say it. Oh my goodness. Oh my, whatever. Gingrich. Whatever you want to say, but don't say it. But how do you create external motives, external incentives, external obligators? Sometimes Gush guys, well, I want to do it for authentic reasons. I want to do it for true reasons, internal motivation, not for anything external, flawed, fake. Sometimes it can be too elitist for your own good. And you search for that true, authentic moment. You set yourself up for an all or nothing, and very often it's a nothing, not at all. So you have to stage yourself. So for example, telling yourself, I'm going to make a siyum on a certain date. That obligates. You know, a date's coming, the deadline's coming, and you have to perform. Well, you learn Torah because you committed yourself to a siyum by a certain date, by Purim, by Pesach, by a yahrzeit date, by... No, but Yaakov already told us. The Gemara Nedarim already told us, David HaMelech already told us that these types of obligators are healthy. Well, if you tell yourself, I'm going to learn X amount every day. What, you're learning because you told yourself that? I'm going to read X amount of Tehillim every day because you told yourself, because it's important to you. I'm going to do a chesed every day. The best advice I can give people who are not in learning frameworks when they leave yeshiva is to establish a reasonable quota of what you're going to learn every day. It should be reasonable. If it's too ambitious, then in reaching for great ambition, you sometimes fall short of more attainable goals. And when a day passes and you didn't, either tax yourself, or, I don't like to use the word punish yourself, but demand of yourself. If on Monday you don't learn your 25 minutes, Tuesday you have to learn 50 minutes. Or pay $3 to stuck. It sounds babyish. Sounds third grade. Right? I don't have third grade anymore where I have to give money to the Pushka box. You'd be surprised how many third graders are still learning Torah. And how many people that thought they left third grade and they don't need these external helpers, how many of them haven't opened a sefer in years? Because it's very easy to let one thing become another, and today I have an excuse, and tomorrow I have an excuse, and Yosef has an excuse, and Eliezer has an excuse, and everyone has an excuse, and no one knows what I'm going through, and my life is harder than everyone else, and if anyone ever knew, and I'm sure all the excuses are valid. No one is making up excuses. They're all valid. Or else they wouldn't work. How do you break through excuses? So should I make a Vechet Targum such an important quote-unquote shvua? Did you know that every week in your life you're going to be finishing a certain piece of Torah Shebichsav with the Rashi, with the Oglis, with the Ramban, and there are no, so if a week passes, you make it up. I still owe Vayeshev and Miketz because I was traveling, and it's like this albatross that follows me. I'm finishing, I still owe Vayeshev and Miketz because I was on the road. I still know that I'm going to make that up. I know that if I miss a day of Tehillim, I have to make up the next day, two days of Tehillim. So it's not just about creating, well, this is my list to do today, and if I missed it, it's got to be an internal awareness, a corresponding internal sensitivity. But it can't just be internal, because your internal moments will be frayed and disturbed by the commotion of life. And sometimes what helps us persevere and withstand the commotion of life is that word I keep discussing again and again and again, commitment, obligation. Judaism cannot be based on commitment and obligation. It also has to be based on love and passion and identification. But the baseline has to be a framework of commitment and obligation upon which you build the structure of identification, of understanding, of intuition, of love, of romance. But it's only that, without the foundation, no sail fast will fall. And that's Yaakov's lesson. By forcing Yosef to take it, I know Yosef, hopefully when you take my body there with Israel, you'll be singing songs of Shechem, you'll be singing Shveki, you'll be dreaming of Aras HaMachpel, you'll be dancing on clouds with angels, the Schustik, but you may not, you may just be schlepping your body, if my body, over to Shechem, to Hebron, to bury my body, and trying to get back as fast as possible. I hope you'll hit the high notes, but even if you don't, here's your shvua, take my body back to Hebron. Okay, let's study. Thank you.